Scrolling for May 15th, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflug.
And I'm Pam Fedor.
We're back again with another daily podcast. They just keep coming, folks. You can come in every day and listen to us be silly and talk about Sherlock Holmes and all of his amazing magic tricks of puzzles that he is solving. Today, the adventure of the golden... You're going to have to say it for me, Pam. How do you say this?
You don't have to say it with a French accent. The adventure of the golden pince-nez.
Pince.
It's a very tough sound.
It is. So explain it. Explain it in a language that I can understand.
It means pinch nose. So pince is pinch. So it's the pinch nose. So it's those little glasses that sit at the end of your nose. They don't have, I don't know if they have like handles or not. They just sit. Pince-nez.
It's those little glasses that help us see and read because we've gotten older, Steve.
Well,
although these ones are very, very strong. And this is the story where the item that's left behind, which happens all the time in that opening sequence of a Sherlock Holmes story, it actually becomes the title of the story, the clue, the big clue. And so usually we see Sherlock reading something for fun, right? Like the walking stick or the watch or whatever. In this case, reading those golden pince-nez is the whole point of the story. So what did you guys think of this story?
Better than yesterday's story.
Okay.
Which yesterday's story was not particularly strong. This one seems, it was okay. You know, we've read so many of them now. We have the story structure down. And I think he's playing a little bit with it, but you know, he's trying to create stories that are going to hold our interest, they're going to be a little more sophisticated, but ultimately he's exploring maybe writing style with this.
And I think in addition to that, he's kind of going through a thematic thing in this collection where two stories in a row seem to be very connected. We had the two stories with the bicycles in a row, the two murders in a row. Here we have two stories in a row with professors, with people hidden in the professors' rooms. I see this theme happening with Doyle.
I like that. I think it's a really good point that this collection, specifically The Return of Sherlock Holmes, does have those dualities that we've kind of talked about. I think in general, though, detective fiction, or really any genre fiction, it's trying to find that balance of comfort and innovation, where it's giving you the really familiar themes that you enjoy so much about Holmes, but also trying to come up with something new. Like in this case, we have like Russians. It's our first time having Russians in the story that I can remember. So, you know, a little bit of that exotic element, but also with all the familiar elements. Like, think about how many things in this story are so familiar. For example, from the beginning, we have that mention of other unwritten cases, and we've seen this from day one. So Watson opens by looking over three massive manuscript volumes for 1894. That's a super busy year for Sherlock's. And then he gives us these little clues. As I turn over the pages, I see my notes upon the repulsive story of the Red Leech and the terrible death of Crosby the banker. Here also I found an account of the Appleton tragedy and the singular contents of the ancient British barrow. And it goes on and on. And so like, these are such interesting, fascinating stories that are not as fascinating as the story of the golden pince-nez.
And again, none of those stories exist, right? These are all stories Doyle is giving us the, and by the way, there's other cases that I haven't told you, and also that invitation that you can write these stories later on.
So I was like, they don't exist, but I mean, they don't exist by Doyle. I'm sure we can find the repulsive story of the Red Leech written by someone else.
I'm sure somebody has written the Red Leech story.
How delightful.
A little bloodletting right there, I'm sure. How else do you solve a fever?
And remember last time Sherlock Holmes was doing some scholarship on treaty law? And this time there's an ancient British barrow. You know what? Just all these outlandish things.
Very eclectic.
All those details, all those little details that Doyle is apt to put in. Here we get a lot of his descriptions of nature once again. We finally get back to a little bit of flowery writing in these short stories.
I really liked at the opening of this story, I felt like the description of London kind of that same poetic flair as we got in Hound of the Baskerville, but this time it's actually in Baker Street. And so we're in Baker Street. Holmes is using his magnifying glass to look at an ancient palimpsest, and Watson is reading a treatise about surgery. And then we get this wonderful description. Outside, the wind howled down Baker Street while the rain beat fiercely against the windows. It was strange there, in the very depths of the town, with 10 miles of man's handiwork on every side of us, to feel the iron grip of nature and to be conscious that to the huge elemental forces, all London was no more than the molehills that dot the fields.
Whew. Yeah, that's really good descriptive narrative. Not as wonderful as The Hound of the Baskervilles, where we got colors and descriptions of the sky. We're missing the sky here. This is just about man's handiwork. But yeah, that's pretty beautiful.
It's the Industrial Revolution in a city. There is no sky.
Right.
Well, and I do think that it's also about perspective, right? It's that notion that we in the middle of London might feel like, wow, we're living in this incredible, you know, civilization that's full of technology and fellowship. But to nature, that just looks like a molehill, right? It just, the whole, all of that handiwork of London is just a blip in nature's enormous force. I don't know. I think that's kind of cool.
I think so too. No
colors.
Yeah, without colors, you got nothing.
Yeah. And then this is one where the, much like Hound of the Baskervilles, the weather really sort of portends the action. So the next day, when they're taking the train and heading out to the Yoxley Old Place, again, we get, I think, a kind of nice description. The gale had blown itself out next day, but it was a bitter morning when we started upon our journey. We saw the cold winter sun rise over the dreary marshes of the Thames and the long sullen reaches of the river, which I shall ever associate with our pursuit of the Andaman Islander in the earlier days of our career. And so we have this, we have like the river, the wind, but also in Watson's mind, we have another story that he hasn't written. And I also like that he says here, the earlier days of our career, not of Holmes's career. Now he feels like fully a part of this detective enterprise, probably because he's given up his own practice as a doctor, even though he's still reading books of surgery.
He's still interested in medicine. It is still his vocation, but his avocation here is important to him. This is who he is. Sherlock is a mentor here again. We have young Stanley Hopkins being the investigator that is coming in here.
While it's raining cats and dogs outside, who appears at the door but young Stanley Hopkins? So now we saw Stanley Hopkins just a few stories ago in The Adventures of Black Peter. And here we see that softer side of Sherlock, who really is super kind to his mentor, not making fun of him the way he makes fun of Watson. And of course, Stanley Hopkins has the proper amount of deference to the more experienced detective. So he comes into the rooms in Baker Street in the midst of this crazy storm. He tells him this whole long story of a murdered secretary in the professor's office. And he tells him all the servants, all the people, blah, blah, blah. And then at the conclusion of the story, he says, "It was a splendid chance of putting your theories into practice, Mr. Sherlock Holmes. There was really nothing wanting." "Except Mr. Sherlock Holmes," said my companion with a somewhat bitter smile. "Well, let us hear about it. What sort of job did you make of it?" So there's that funny sort of, he recognizes like he can put all the things in play, but he still needs the master himself in order to solve the problem.
And this is certainly a very different relationship that Holmes has with the Stanley Hopkins than Holmes has with Lestrade, where Lestrade many times was this bumbling kind of guy, at least early on. Mm-hmm. And now with Hopkins, I don't know, maybe they have a lot more reverence for each other.
Yeah.
This is another info dump too. This is paragraph after paragraph after paragraph of the evidence before the action. And
with a diagram and everything.
With a diagram that I didn't find any use of. I don't know why that diagram was included.
I stopped and looked at it because I was going, this must be important.
But it turns out that it wasn't.
No. The picture of Steve. It's a throw. It's you know, magicians. They use little things to kind of look over here, look over here. The magic is over here.
Well, I think the idea, and I didn't notice it either, but was to see that there must have been a hidden room. I don't know. But after I didn't look at it as carefully as you guys did. So Hopkins tells Holmes that he thinks his next step is to go and talk to the London opticians about this pair of glasses that he's found. Holmes says, "Of course you would. Meanwhile, have you anything more to tell us about the case?" And I love Hopkins's response. "Nothing, Mr. Holmes. I think that you now know as much as I do. Probably more." And, and you know, I think Holmes likes that. Holmes likes that he is now sort of accepted. I mean, as Lestrade told him, everyone at Scotland Yard, from the youngest constable to the chief inspector, everybody respects you and is so glad that you're on our side. And Sherlock has arrived at this point in his career, and he likes that.
Well, we have the scene in The Six Napoleons where he's doing this whole act of smashing the final head, and Lestrade and Watson are clapping for him.
Exactly.
I mean, absolutely he enjoys this accolade and this young inspector who is giving him some of that positive reinforcement of he is the master.
Yep.
For my next trick, I shall pull a rabbit out of my hat.
The trick here is he's reading these glasses and telling us all about the woman who owns these glasses. And boy, it is quite a picture that we get of this lady.
And I love that he even presents it in a little want ad.
Right. It starts with the word wanted, because he is writing a wanted ad here.
No, it reminds me a little bit of the sort of newer, like from the 1970s on, form of detective fiction that has the police profiler. So where they look at, and it's typically a serial killer, so it's not at all like this, but where they look at the different cases and then they come up with a profile, a psychological profile. And, you know, white man between 28 and 35 lives alone, you know, that kind of profile. And here we have, just from this one piece of evidence, the glasses, Holmes is coming up with a physical description of the person we want.
And it's not a pretty picture here.
No.
She has a large nose. Her eyes are narrowly set. She has a puckered forehead. That one I questioned. What does a puckered forehead mean to you?
I think it means that because she's super nearsighted, she has kind of like her lines are going towards the bridge of her nose.
Like she's always squinting.
And, exactly.
And squinting up not only her eyes, but her whole forehead, her whole face is squinty. Yeah, that's what I read as well. And then she's hunched over with rounded shoulders. This is not a pretty picture he's painting here from these glasses.
But it's very distinct. We would be able to, we gotta, you know, as we're walking around, we can look out for this lady. We'll recognize her.
Sherlock really likes tobacco and really loves to smoke, doesn't he?
Of course he does, too.
And, you know, this is mentioned many times throughout the story. He's even written a small monograph on different forms of tobacco ash. But here, my goodness, I don't think we've ever seen him chain smoke like this.
Well, he did have the room that was full of smoke where he was.
Oh, that's true. Yes, you're right. You're right.
So, yes. Yeah,
this is a little bit different, where we're actually watching a man chain smoke three full cigarettes and starting a fourth in the amount of time that the professor gives four paragraphs of testimony. This is a lot of smoking that's happening here.
Well, it's an appetite suppressant, Steve. It It calms the nerves. It's good for digestion. I mean, there's so many wonderful attributes to
good for digestion. Where are you coming up with this stuff? It curbs the appetite. How's that good for digestion?
Listen, I have seen all the some people call it propaganda, but others just call it science.
Pseudoscience?
Possibly. You never know. It was paid for by the American Tobacco Association.
The professor is giving his own point of view on the investigation. He seems really a suspicious character at this point. And he's directing that maybe the young man committed suicide, and he believes that no one else was in the room. And he's very adamant about his feelings.
Oh, good Lord.
I know. Yeah, this professor sort of signposts his own guilt pretty easily, doesn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, this seems pretty obvious when we're reading this going, well, what evidence are you presenting here? You're saying these words, but what evidence do you have that he had suicidal tendencies at all?
Well, obviously the professor is also in distress because his research may not be completed at this point. He points that out.
Yes, and that's true. Like, we have that monomania that was referenced but was the wrong answer with Napoleon's, but here maybe it's the right answer.
So we get to the end of the story that the solution is the murderer, and it was an accident, so we can't exactly call it murderer, but the
manslaughter.
Okay. The accused is there in the room with them the whole time. And she comes out of the closet, literally, and she is a Russian who has apparently been married to the professor for some time.
And here again, we have that notion of a young woman who's mistreated. So now she's middle age, but she tells us that she, the young woman with the golden pince-nez, was 20 when she married the professor who was 50 at the time. And she starts talking about the Russian Revolution. We were reformers, revolutionists, nihilists, you understand. He and I, the professor, and many more. Then there came a time of trouble. A police officer was killed. Many were arrested. Evidence was wanted. And in order to save his own life and earn a great reward, my husband betrayed his own wife and his companions. The husband being this professor who now lives in England. And Anna, it turns out, had what she calls a friend of my heart who was convicted of a crime he didn't commit because he was trying to protect her. So Alexis is now in a prison in Siberia. And she has come to the professor's house, broken into his home to find documents that would save Alexis. So yeah, it's a kind of crazy story. And again, one that Sherlock and anyone else couldn't just come up with, in the same way that in The Three Students, Sherlock wouldn't have been able to guess that Bannister was the butler at young Gilchrist's home when he was a child. So there's a little bit less fair play than we've had in a lot of the stories.
Yeah, there's also a vial, because that's always the useful solution.
That's a Russian thing, right?
The suicide vial.
Yeah.
Carrying the vial of poison in a locket around your neck or whatever, so that if you
get in a tight spot, you have an exit.
Well, it's not really an exit. You're still there, but you're not living.
Well, and no one can take the information from you, right? Being tortured. And here I think it's interesting because she's in the opposite position, because she's a young woman who's been mistreated. She's in the opposite position of like a Russian spy who would take the vial so as to not give up information. She wants to give information. Once she has given the information and the documents over, now she's ready to die. So that places her as a victim rather than a killer.
True. I agree with that. She is in the middle of this revolution. The Russian Revolution is still ongoing at this time. It started in 1861 and was not over until 1924. So she is in that spy, getting information and trying to bring down the government part of the history here.
Yeah, I was just thinking that I we read a book on that. We A Gentleman in Moscow, towards the end of the Russian Revolution, that described part of that. There's a lot to unpack. I guess I could take a world history course or learn something more about the Russian Revolution. It's always interesting.
And that's what Doyle is giving you here, is that opportunity to delve deeper into this idea. Just like when he was mentioning the Italians in the one story and all the Americans that he's mentioned in other stories, that he's bringing in all of these historical pieces that you certainly could go and do some more investigation.
Yeah. And then after we meet Anna, that's when we find out that Sherlock's chain smoking here wasn't just about his great love of tobacco. He was actually doing it in order to figure out where the woman was hiding.
Because he was sure that the woman was hiding in this room. He was sure that she had not left. So all of these cigarettes that he was smoking in a very short amount of time, he was ashing these cigarettes all over the room, and no one noticed, and no one asked him to stop making a huge mess in this man's room. Seriously? Right?
And nobody cleaned his room, because, you know, why would we do that?
Well, we have had a murder, so I mean, I suppose.
But we're going to contaminate the crime scene here with all my ashes.
Exactly.
Smoke around here. But don't worry, there's a rhyme to the reason, right?
Yeah, it worked.
It worked.
It worked. So you can question my methods if they don't work, but if they do work, you don't really have to question my methods. The story ends pretty abruptly there, right? Anna comes out of the closet, tells us the whole story about what's happening, and says that she is poisoned and that she is about to die. And then
it's
they're on a train.
Me apart.
Right. And then and they're so, on a train, and then we get a really long paragraph of explanation of what happened after that without actually telling us what happened after that.
Well, and you know, as usual, Holmes explains his methods and the cigarette ash and finding the room and recognizing that there's no way this heavy smoker had eaten as much as the food that was gone from his tray, etc. So then at the very end, they get to the train station. It's time to change trains. "Well, Hopkins," says Holmes, "here we are at Charing Cross, and I congratulate you on having brought your case to a successful conclusion. You are going to headquarters, no doubt. I think, Watson, you and I will drive together to the Russian embassy." And so this is kind of like Sherlock the mentor again, right? "Hey, young man, good job of finishing your case, which I solved for you. But you go back to Scotland Yard and let them know of your good work." And then he's following up on what this woman, Anna, wanted. He's got her documents. They're going to the Russian embassy. They're going to free Alexis, the friend of Anna's heart, from the Siberian prison. So, like, good work all around.
It's a very interesting ending. It's a very different ending from what we've gotten in the past. It is a long paragraph of info dump of how this was solved, as opposed to a dialogue that we usually get at the end.
Yeah. In fact, you know, I sat down and I was thinking about the story and immediately brought, you know, there was a moral to the ending of it that I immediately saw. I could be wrong, but I saw it. It said, and I should probably point that out, you know, the great state of North Carolina would like to remind you that smoking is good for you. And as trustworthy as Sherlock Holmes is, smoking can help solve our important mysteries. Bless Sherlock Holmes, and bless the golden and smooth tasting tobacco leaf, and bless you, consumer of one of life's pleasures. So I immediately thought that was the moral, although I could be wrong. Maybe I could.
Thank you, Chip. I feel like you've really gotten to the bottom of this. So wait, are you from North Carolina?
Oh, you mean where the vegetable tobacco is grown? Of course I am. They sat us down early and they taught us all about this magic golden leaf that that provides so much for the.
Good Lord.
Well, I'm sure I've never mentioned that I'm from Canada, where we sometimes get a little bit of 6 inches of snow yesterday.
A consumer of tobacco.
Indeed, indeed. Oh dear.
Oh dear. This is certainly an oh dear kind of story, isn't it? It's a good enough mystery, but it's certainly not on our top list of our favorite stories.
Well, I think that this set of mysteries, The Return of Sherlock Holmes, it's got some of the very best mysteries of the whole canon. And, like, no offense, but some of the, like, not so fantastic ones. This one was fine. But I do think that when we do our wrap-up episode, we're each going to have a different top choice. And among some very good top choices to choose from, there are also, like, some, you know, bottom choices available in this collection.
Yeah, I would call this one of the weaker mysteries.
Steve, Mystery Science Theater, they probably could riff this one, couldn't they?
I'm sure somebody made a film version of this particular story. I'll have to look that up. But yes, this would be very riffable. I was riffing during the reading of this. Like,
totally.
Wait, he's ashing all over the room and nobody is stopping him? How is that?
And let me have another cigarette there, big guy.
Boy, oh boy. Four cigarettes in four paragraphs of text. Like, really? That's a lot of cigarettes.
Especially now they're like $20 a pack with all the taxes thrown on.
Okay. So how about you, listeners? What do you think? Was this one of your favorites? Is this a shrug? Are we going to forget this one when we get to our wrap-up episode of The Return of Sherlock Holmes? Tell us what you think. We would love to hear from you. Give us a voicemail or an email. Follow our hashtag TMSSherlockHolmes for all of that feedback from around the world. And tune in tomorrow for the adventure of the missing three-quarter. That's in English. I can say those words.
It doesn't really roll off the tongue, though. The missing three-quarter.
Three-quarter. Yeah. We'll have to find out.
If they only said it in French. Oh, it sounds so much cooler.
So much more intelligent in French, for sure. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Pesson-Flan.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
We'll see you in the future.
What I wanna talk about is what I wanna thank you for. What I wanna thank you for.
Rise over the dreary marshes of the Thames. Oh my gosh, please.
Seriously?
I'm in New London, where our river is called the Thames. So I switched over. Forgive me. I'm so serious. It took me like 10 years, and now I just do it.